Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 112. It's Monday, May 3rd. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, of course, we still live in a pandemic that is raging, but this week we're going to try to move out of mostly COVID-19 stories to quite a wide array of other public health stories. But let's start with some stories to help us navigate and orient ourselves to the pandemic that we are all in. First up, from the Associated Press, India launches effort to inoculate all adults against COVID-19. In hopes of taming a monstrous spike in COVID-19 infections, India opened vaccinations to all adults Saturday, launching a huge inoculation effort that was sure to tax the limits of the federal government, the country's vaccine factories, and the patience of its 1.4 billion people. The world's largest maker of vaccines was still short of critical supplies, the result of lagging manufacturing and raw material shortages that delayed the rollout in several states. And even in places where the shots were in stock, the country's wide economic disparities made access to the vaccine very inconsistent. Only a fraction of India's population will be able to afford the prices charged by private hospitals for the shot, experts said, meaning that states will be saddled with immunizing the 600 million Indian adults younger than 45, while the federal government gives shots to 300 million healthcare and frontline workers and people older than 45. So far, government vaccines have been free, and private hospitals have been permitted to sell shots at a price capped at 250 rupees, or around $3. That practice will now change. Prices for state governments and private hospitals will be determined by vaccine companies. Some states might not be able to provide vaccines for free since they are paying twice as much as the federal government for the same shot, and prices at private hospitals could rise. Since state governments and private players compete for shots in the same marketplace, and states pay less for the doses, vaccine makers can reap more profits by selling to the private sector, said Chandra Kant Laharia, a health policy expert. That cost can then be passed on to people receiving the shots, increasing inequity. There is no logic that two different governments should be paying two prices, he said. Concerns that pricing issues could deepen inequities are only the most recent hitch in India's sluggish immunization efforts. Less than 2% of the population has been fully immunized against COVID-19, and around 10% has received at least a single dose. Immunization rates have also fallen. The average number of shots per day dipped from over 3.6 million in early April to less than 2.5 million right now. In a positive development, the country on Saturday received its first batch of Sputnik V vaccines, which it is importing from Russia. Moscow has signed a deal with an Indian pharmaceutical company to distribute 125 million doses. Indian vaccine makers produce an estimated 70 million doses each month of the two approved shots, the AstraZeneca vaccine made by the Serum Institute of India and another one made by Bharat Biotech, both requiring two doses. Okay, just stop for a minute to put that in perspective. That 70 million doses per month is about 2.5% of India's population if you'd get the full two doses getting fully vaccinated. And at that rate, it would take well over a year for India to get to where the U.S. is today as far as the number of people, the percentage or proportion of people that are vaccinated today in the U.S. Okay, back to the story. The federal government is buying half of those vaccines to give to states. The remaining half can then be bought by states and private hospitals to be given to anyone over 18, but at prices set by the companies. The urgent demand for vaccines in India is bad for the rest of the world, said Ravi Gupta, a professor of clinical microbiology at Cambridge University. Some experts warn that conducting a massive inoculation effort now could worsen the surge in a country that is second only to the United States in its number of infections, with more than 19 million infections. There's ample evidence that having people wait in long, crowded, disorderly queues could itself be a source of infection, said Dr. Bharat Panghania, a senior clinical lecturer specializing in infectious disease at Britain's University of Exeter. He urged India to first stop the circulation of the virus by imposing a long, sustained, strictly enforced lockdown. He cautioned that immunization efforts alone would not help immediately stem the current spike of COVID-19, since shots only start to bear fruit in about 3 months' time. Vaccination would help prevent future waves of infection, he said. Given the urgent need for vaccines, some experts said rationing available doses is critical. Vaccines need to be delivered to the areas with the most intense transmission, Gupta said, explaining that vaccines should be used as emergency control measures in specific regions in India rather than offering doses to all adults across the subcontinent. It is better globally to immunize all the vulnerable people that need to be protected rather than to immunize entire populations in only some countries. Of course, as we know, one of the banes of effective public health is that people rush to the crisis right in front of their nose rather than taking the long look and playing the long game and taking a rational approach, in this case, to vaccinating the most vulnerable first before just kind of willy-nilly trying to vaccinate everybody that might not be the most targeted and most effective in preventing disease and new infection. Okay, well, the U.S. is starting to reorient itself to the fact that we're in a pandemic and need to be doing things worldwide. This from Associated Press. U.S. to launch trade talks on COVID-19 vaccine distribution. The U.S. top trade negotiator will begin talks with the World Trade Organization on ways to overcome intellectual property issues that are keeping critically needed COVID-19 vaccines from being more widely distributed worldwide, two White House officials said Sunday. The White House has been under pressure from lawmakers at home and governments abroad to join an effort to waive patent rules for the vaccines so that poor countries can begin to produce their own generic versions of the shots to vaccinate their populations. The U.S. has been criticized for focusing first on vaccinating Americans, particularly as its vaccine supply begins to outpace demand and doses approved for use elsewhere in the world, but not in the U.S., sit idle. U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai will be starting talks with the trade organization on how we can get this vaccine more widely distributed, more widely licensed, more widely shared, said the White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain. Sullivan said the administration believes pharmaceutical companies should be supplying at scale and at cost to the entire world so there is no barrier to anyone getting vaccinated. Klain said that the U.S. has sent India enough of the raw materials it needs to make 20 million vaccine doses immediately. And of course, those large numbers are hard to really understand what they mean. Let's take a look at that. 20 million vaccine doses immediately. And of course, that's raw materials, meaning you have to plug it in to the factories that produce them. But 20 million doses, the earlier story, they talked about India cranking out 70 million doses per month. So that those raw materials the U.S. is supplying would provide less than 30% of what a typical monthly supply would be. So significant, but perhaps not game-changing. And perhaps more importantly, if you look at that 20 million doses and the vaccines that are approved in India require two doses to be fully vaccinated, so that would be 10 million people. That's less than 1% of India's population. So we have a long, long, long way to go. Okay, and once you start with messing with patents, you're going to get a bevy of lobbyists. So this from The Intercept. Pharmaceutical industry dispatches army of lobbyists to block generic COVID-19 vaccines. The pharmaceutical industry is pouring resources into the growing political fight over generic coronavirus vaccines. Newly filed disclosure forms from the first quarter of 2021 showed that over 100 lobbyists had been mobilized to contact lawmakers and members of the Biden administration, urging them to oppose a proposed temporary waiver on intellectual property rights by the World Trade Organization that would allow generic vaccines to be produced globally. Pharmaceutical lobbyists working against the proposal include Mike McKay, a key fundraiser for House Democrats now working on retainer for Pfizer, as well as several former staff members of the U.S. Office of Trade Representative, which oversees negotiations with the World Trade Organization. Several trade groups funded by pharmaceutical firms have also focused closely on defeating the generic proposal, new disclosures show. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, and the International Intellectual Property Alliance, which all receive drug company money, have dispatched dozens of lobbyists to oppose the initiative. The push has been followed by a number of influential voices taking the side of the drug lobby. Last week, Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, released a letter demanding that the administration, quote, oppose any and all efforts aimed at waiving intellectual property rights. Howard Dean, the former Democratic National Committee chair, has similarly criticized the proposal, echoing many of the arguments of the drug industry. Currently, only 1% of coronavirus vaccines are going to low-income countries, and projections show much of the world's population may not be vaccinated until 2023 or 2024. In response, a coalition of countries, led by India and South Africa, have petitioned the World Trade Organization to temporarily suspend intellectual property rights on coronavirus-related medical products so that generic vaccines can be rapidly manufactured. The waiver requests a suspension of intellectual property enforcement under the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, or the TRIPS Treaty. If granted, local pharmaceutical plants could be granted compulsory licenses to produce coronavirus vaccines without the threat of being sued by the license holder. The proposal has gained traction globally, with hundreds of members of the European Parliament, dozens of American lawmakers led by Senator Bernie Sanders, and increasingly vocal voices in the public health community expressing support. But the waiver petition has encountered fierce opposition from leading drug companies who stand to lose profit and who fear that allowing a waiver would lead to less stringent intellectual property enforcement in the future. The scarcity of vaccines is not because of intellectual property, but because of regrettable production and distribution challenges, wrote Michelle McMurray Heath, the president of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization, the trade group that represents Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson, in an opinion column for The Economist. But global public health activists remain skeptical. The drug company lobbyists are saying the TRIPS waiver won't increase the supply of vaccines. But if that's true, why do they oppose it? Because they think it will, in fact, expand production, noted James Love, director of Knowledge Ecology International, a group that supports the waiver petition. The waiver itself, from a legal point of view, is most important for eliminating two restrictive provisions on the TRIPS, both dealing with exports, added Love. From a political point of view, it is more important giving a green light to use existing compulsory licensing authority and putting pressure on vaccine manufacturers to do more voluntary agreements. And while the voluntary COVAX approach aims to supply 2 billion vaccine doses, the initiative has been plagued by delays and underfunding and has only shipped 40 million doses. Brooke Baker, a law professor at Northeastern University and senior policy analyst with HealthGap, also noted that the drug industry appears to be mounting a counteroffensive over growing demands for the TRIPS waiver. This includes the small army of high-paid lobbyists that includes many ex-Capitol Hill figures and staffers, but it also includes publicity campaigns and op-eds by industry shills directly challenging the waiver and predicting pharma doom if it is adopted, Baker said. This industry will do anything to protect its intellectual property and trade secrets, even as it can't and won't meet vaccine needs in developing countries. Baker has called on the administration to not only grant the waiver, but to make it clear to the American public that we cannot achieve and sustain COVID vaccine immunity until and unless all the world is vaccinated. So far, the Biden administration has declined to take a position on the waiver. U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai has said she's reviewing the issue and has met with both representatives of the drug lobby and activists in support of the initiative. And as the coronavirus ravages India, this from The Hill. State Department urging Americans to leave India as COVID-19 cases surge. The State Department is urging all Americans to leave India as the country grapples with the devastating wave of coronavirus cases that's pushing its health system to a breaking point. In a level 4 travel alert, the highest level that can be issued by the State Department, the U.S. Embassy in India sounded the alarm over the availability of medical care and pressed Americans to take advantage of the daily flights that are available out of India back to the U.S. So put this in a little bit of context. This is not only because India puts you at high risk for actually getting COVID, and that if you get COVID, you may not be able to get medical care, but because the Indian healthcare system is so overwhelmed, if you need any kind of serious medical care, it very well might not be available. So it's advising Americans to get out. Okay, well, let's return a little closer to home and look at the local COVID-19 update. Well, we've been living in the shadow of Michigan's epidemic here. But the good news is that Michigan's trajectory is looking much, much better. But Michigan is still at very high rates of new infections. In Lucas County, the average daily number of cases over the last 7 days is bumped down to 100 per day, down from 106 the previous week. But of course, 69 out of 88 Ohio counties is still at the highest incidence category that the Ohio Department of Health has. This is one county less than we had last week, but still obviously the overwhelming majority of counties. So we're still in a thick of it in Ohio. And here's an interesting little story about Ohio might be approaching this. Our governor here, this from the Akron Beacon Journal. Ohio COVID-19 maps. Statewide case rate falls again, but still not enough to end mask mandate. The number Ohio is using to determine if all coronavirus health orders will be dropped went down for the second week in a row, but it's still not anywhere near low enough to meet the threshold that will lift Ohio's coronavirus health orders. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said that if Ohio hits 50 or fewer new COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents during the previous 2 weeks, excluding inmates in prisons and jails, all coronavirus health orders, including a statewide mask mandate, will be rolled back or lifted. So today, it's about 187,000 per 100,000. So, you know, we're way more than triple what this metric is that governors set in order to get rid of these health orders. But it's possible the orders could be lifted sooner than Ohio meets the 50 per 100,000 threshold. DeWine has also said the state is exploring switching to using vaccination rates instead of the statewide case rate to determine when to lift the health orders. In neighboring Kentucky, most restrictions will be lifted once 2.5 million residents get at least their first shot. And for context, that's about 56% of Kentucky residents. I suspect this might very well be a good example of moving the goalposts. Gotta open the states, and if you can't do it based on that darn metric that you set, change the metric. And I would say that while getting people vaccinated is a super important thing for ending this pandemic, it's pretty much the only way we're ever going to be able to do it. It's not the best metric. You really need to look something a little bit closer about what's actually happening on the ground. And that has to do with cases or at least hospitalizations or deaths. But it very well could change because, of course, we want to bump it up sooner to opening everything up. So stay tuned for more info in coming weeks. Okay, well, of course, I've been tracking a lot of different metrics in Ohio here. And we have some good news as far as the testing positivity rates. That means the people who seek testing out and get tested, the proportion or the percent that actually test positive. That has moved down to 7.5% from 9.5% in the previous week. So that's a pretty good drop, and it's been dropping pretty fast the last couple weeks, so that's a really good sign. The 7.5% is still pretty high, but the trajectory is going in the right direction and quite speedily. And it dropped a bit in Ohio as well, down to 3.8% from 4.5% the week before. So good news for Ohio. Now, looking at the long-term care facilities or nursing homes in Lucas County, we had 29 active cases in the most recent week. That was 13 residents and 16 staff. That's a little bit of a drop. We've been holding around the 30 mark or so the last month. So still got some problems there, but at least it's not getting worse. I guess that's good news. New hospitalizations are trending down in both Lucas County and Ohio, just barely in Ohio, a little bit more robustly in Lucas County. But of course, we have a little bit more severe epidemic here. The Lucas County death rate is held at 16 deaths in the last 14 days, the last several weeks. And that rate turns out to be higher than both the state and national death rate. So not particularly great news that shows you the persistence and that the lagging of death rates over hospitalizations and cases. Well, University of Toledo is just about ready to end its academic year, and they had a record low of only 3 identified infections over the most recent week, and they identified nobody from their surveillance testing, where they normally test several hundred people to see if they can identify asymptomatic cases and such. So good news, way good way to end the year, University of Toledo. Well, not quite the same story with the Lucas County schools. Last week, I reported that we had a record number of cases. We had over 178 students that were infected. Well, it's bumped down a little bit. We had 143 identified infections, 127 of those in students. That leaves 16 for staff. So it still looks like we're getting a pretty high level of infections among Lucas County school students and staff. Okay, well, vaccines can keep plugging along. And the nice thing about vaccines is it's the long game, because every couple percent of the population that we add each week kind of gets taken off the table of this epidemic and pandemic. And nationwide, we're up to 42.2% of the U.S. 44.3% of the U.S. population that has had at least one dose. We're around 40% for Ohio and Lucas County, a little bit lower. So come on, Ohio, get your game up. Okay, and I've been tracking the racial ethnic disparity by looking at the ratio of blacks to whites that have been vaccinated. And Lucas County has been sticking stubbornly at around 50%, bumped up to a whopping 51%, meaning that blacks in Lucas County are 51% as likely to be vaccinated as whites. When we started looking at that a couple months ago, we were at 45%. So we bumped up a massive 6% over that time period. In Ohio, it bumped up a couple extra points to 61% as likely for blacks as whites. And that has came up from a low of 49% in the state a couple months ago when we started tracking this. Of course, if you want to get a vaccination, everybody age 16 plus in Ohio is eligible. You can go to gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. And a new resource this week, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department now has a COVID-19 vaccine hotline staffed Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. to schedule, change, or cancel an appointment, or just for COVID-19 information. Feel free to call 419-213-4100, option 1, during business hours, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Again, that number is 419-213-4100, option 1. You are listening to Just for the Health of It, a weekly public health program airing on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. The only tuition you need to pay is your time and attention. And my guarantee to you is if you listen to this show diligently for a year, you will, in fact, know more about public health than 99% of the citizens around you. Okay, well, let's move to some public health stories beyond simply COVID. This from Kaiser Health News. Public health experts worry about boom-bust cycle of support. Congress has poured tens of billions of dollars into state and local public health departments in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, paying for masks, contact tracers, and education campaigns to persuade people to get vaccinated. Public health officials who have juggled bare-bone budgets for years are happy to have the additional money, yet they worry it will soon dry up as the pandemic recedes, continuing a boom-bust funding cycle that has plagued the U.S. public health system for decades. If budgets are slashed again, they warn, that could leave the nation where it was before COVID, unprepared for a health crisis. We need funds that we can depend on year after year, said Dr. Myshika Roberts, the health commissioner of Columbus, Ohio. Something happens, we throw a ton of money at it, then a year or two we go back to our shrunken budgets and we can't do the minimum things we have to do day in and day out, let alone be prepared for the next emergency, said Chrissy Giuliano, executive director of the Big Cities Health Coalition, which represents leaders of more than two dozen public health departments. Funding for public health emergency preparedness, which pays for emergency capabilities for state and local health departments, dropped by about half between the 2003 and 2021 fiscal years, accounting for inflation, according to Trust for America's Health, a public health research and advocacy organization. Even the Federal Prevention and Public Health Fund, established with the Affordable Care Act to provide $2 billion a year for public health, was raided for cash over the past decade. If the money hadn't been touched, eventually local and state health departments would have gotten an additional $12.4 billion. Several lawmakers led by Democratic U.S. Senator Patty Murray of Washington are looking to end the boom-bust cycle with legislation that would eventually provide $4.5 billion in core public health funding. Health departments carry out essential government functions, such as managing water safety, issuing death certificates, tracking sexually transmitted diseases, and preparing for infectious outbreaks. Spending for state public health departments dropped by 16% per capita from 2010 to 2019, and spending for local health departments fell by 18%, Kaiser Health News and the Associated Press found in a July investigation. At least 38,000 public health jobs were lost at the state and local level between the 2008 recession and 2019. Today, many public health workers are hired on a temporary or part-time basis. Some are paid so poorly they qualify for public aid. Those factors reduce departments' ability to retain people with expertise. Compounding those losses, the pandemic has prompted an exodus of public health officials because of harassment, political pressure, and exhaustion. A year-long analysis by the Associated Press and Kaiser Health News found that at least 248 leaders of state and local health departments resigned, retired, or were fired between April 1, 2020 and March 31, 2021. Nearly one in six Americans lost a local public health leader during the pandemic. Experts say it's the largest exodus of public health leaders in American history. Brian Castrucci, CEO of the DeBeaumont Foundation, which advocates for public health, calls Congress's giant influx of cash in response to the crisis, quote, wallpaper and drapes, because it doesn't restore public health's crumbling foundation. Castrucci and others say dependable money is needed for high school professionals, such as epidemiologists, those data-driven disease detectives, and for technology upgrades that would help track outbreaks and get information to the public. In Ohio, the computer system used to report cases to the states predates the invention of the iPhone. State officials had said for years they wanted to upgrade it, but they lacked the money and political will. Many departments across the country have relied on fax machines to report COVID cases. During the pandemic, Ohio's state auditor found that nearly 96% of local health departments it surveyed had problems with the state's disease reporting system. Robert said workers interviewing patients had to navigate several pages of questions, a major burden when handling 500 cases daily. The system was so outdated that some information could be entered only in a non-searchable comment box, and officials struggled to pull data from the system to report to the public, such as how many people who tested positive had attended a Black Lives Matter rally, which last summer was a key question for people trying to understand whether protests contributed to the virus's spread. Ohio is working on a new system, but Roberts worries that, without a dependable budget, the state won't be able to keep that one up to date either. You're going to need to upgrade that, Roberts said, and you're going to need dollars to support that. In Washington, the public health director for Seattle and King County, Patty Hayes, said she is asked all the time why there isn't a single central place to register for a vaccine appointment. The answer comes down to money. Years of underfunding left departments across the state with antiquated computer systems that were not up to the task when COVID hit. Hayes recalls a time when her department would conduct mass vaccination drills, but that system was dismantled when the money dried up after the specter of 9/11 faded. Public health officials in some areas may struggle to make the case for more stable funding because a large swath of the public has questioned, and often been openly hostile toward, the mask mandates and business restrictions that public health officials have imposed through the pandemic. In Missouri, some county commissioners who were frustrated at public health restrictions withheld money from the departments. In Knox County, Tennessee, Mayor Glenn Jacobs narrated a video posted in the fall that showed a photo of health officials with, after referencing, quote, sinister forces. Later, someone spray-painted death on the department office building. The Board of Health was stripped of its power in March and given an advisory role. A spokesman for the mayor's office declined to comment on the video. This is going to change the position of public health and what we can and cannot do across the country, said Dr. Martha Buchanan, the head of the health department. I know it's going to change it here. The Kaiser Health News and AP investigation in December found that at least 24 states were crafting legislation that would limit or remove public health powers. They'll look back at this response to the pandemic in this country as a great example of a failure of a country to prioritize the health of its citizens because it didn't commit to public health, she said. That will be part of the story. In my view, effective public health leadership inescapably runs into political activism for social justice. And this next story from Stat News gets at that. Do public health officials need to be political activists? A fight over an HIV crisis renews the question. Most local health officials don't accept their jobs expecting to be roped into political activism. Amid COVID-19, though, politics became a central element of a health expert's job descriptions. In Washington, government researcher Anthony Fauci publicly feuded with former President Trump. In many cities and states, local health departments were forced to square off against governors who resisted coronavirus mitigation strategies like business closures or mask mandates. The series of squabbles has raised the question of whether, to be effective, local health officials need to add politics to their list of day-to-day responsibilities. And while the fights have been most pronounced amid the pandemic, they've even cropped up in states otherwise lauded for the coronavirus response, like West Virginia. There, the dynamic has played out in the context of a worst-in-the-nation HIV outbreak linked to injection drug use. This month, as local officials scrambled to prevent further spread, the state legislature all but banned one of their most effective tools for doing so, syringe exchanges that distribute sterile needles to people whose drug use places them at high risk of infection. Working 7 days a week on things that are outside our area of expertise, the political backlash against popular strategies, it has taken its toll nationwide on our public health workforce, said Michael Kilkenny, the CEO of the Cabell Huntington Health Department in West Virginia, which serves the hardest hit city of Huntington. It is frustrating, and we see what the consequences are. Willingly or not, local health officials' involvement in local West Virginia politics has been slowly escalating since 2018, when Charleston, the state's largest city, closed its only city-run needle exchange. This month, several local officials vocally opposed a controversial bill aimed at tightly regulating syringe exchange programs, but the state Senate eventually approved it on a 27-7 vote. We now have a state law that makes it illegal to run a program based on CDC best practices, said Robin Polini, an epidemiology professor at West Virginia University. HIV prevention advocates say the move comes at the worst possible time. The state's HIV case count, proportional to its population, is already among the worst nationally. Kanawha County, which is the state's largest at 180,000 residents, recorded roughly as many HIV cases in 2019 as all of New York City, where 8 million people live. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has warned that the known HIV cases in West Virginia could represent just the tip of the iceberg of a much larger crisis. Syringe exchanges have long been demonstrated to be effective tools used to prevent people who use drugs from sharing needles and, in the process, spreading diseases like HIV or hepatitis C. If you understand the science and you're a public health person, you have to make an effort to turn public opinion, she said. And, well, one of the chronic difficulties in public health is if you're doing your job well, people won't notice. There are a lot of ongoing issues that have to be dealt with, and it's only when you have outbreaks that people start paying attention. Well, here's another one. America's STD rate at record high again. There's another epidemic sweeping the United States, sexually transmitted diseases, or STDs. Statistics for 2019, the latest data available from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, show that STD rates in the United States hit a new high again for the sixth straight year. In 2019, nearly 2.5 million Americans had an infection of chlamydia, gonorrhea, or syphilis, the CDC said, and early data from 2020 suggests that these trends are continuing. It's a dramatic and unnecessary comeback for illnesses Americans had nearly defeated. Less than 20 years ago, gonorrhea rates in the U.S. were at historic lows, syphilis was close to elimination, and advances in chlamydia diagnostics made it easier to detect infections, researcher Raul Romaguirre, acting director of CDC's Division of STD Prevention, said. That progress has since unraveled, and our STD defenses are down. We must prioritize and focus our efforts to regain this lost ground and control the spread of STDs, he said. The new research found about 2.5 million cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis in 2019, which is an almost 30% increase in these STDs between 2015 and 2019. Gay and bisexual men accounted for nearly half of all 2019 primary and secondary syphilis cases, the CDC reported. The highest increase was syphilis among newborns, which nearly quadrupled between 2015 and 2019. The CDC explained that people with these STDs do not always have symptoms, but if untreated, some can increase the risk of HIV or cause chronic pelvic pain, pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, severe complications for pregnancy and newborns, and even infant death. Although many sexually transmitted infections are treatable with antibiotics, they make the human body more vulnerable to other infections, including viruses, which are not generally curable. They also have long-term and far-reaching effects on health and fertility for our population. Although STD increased across many groups in 2019, racial and ethnic minorities, gay and bisexual men, and youth were hit the hardest. According to the report, STD rates were 5 to 8 times higher for black people than for white people, 3 to 5 times higher for American Indian or Alaskan Native and Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islanders than for whites, 1 to 2 times higher for Hispanics than whites. Gay and bisexual men accounted for nearly half of all 2019 primary and secondary syphilis cases. Gonorrhea rates were 42 times higher among heterosexual men in some areas. Young people aged 15 to 24 made up 61% of chlamydia cases and 42% of gonorrhea cases. To effectively reduce these disparities, the social, cultural, and economic conditions that make it more difficult for some populations to stay healthy must be addressed. These include poverty, unstable housing, drug use, lack of medical insurance or regular medical provider, and high burden of STDs in some communities, she added. Outreach efforts can help, the CDC researchers said, including STD Express clinics that provide testing and treatment without a full clinical exam, and partnerships with pharmacies and health clinics that can create new places for STD services like testing and treatment. Telehealth service can also bridge gaps in testing and treatment, especially in rural areas. But what about protecting yourself from an STD? You cannot tell if someone has a sexually transmitted infection by looking at them. Just because someone doesn't have a discharge or a sore doesn't mean they're not infectious. She said that, barring sexual abstinence, tried and true barrier methods such as condoms and dental dams can slash your odds for an STD. And getting the HPV vaccine will help protect you against cervical and penile cancer. This is approved for up to age 46 for both men and women. Okay, and moving internationally, this from Medical Express. HIV self-test prices to be slashed in half in 135 countries. Poor countries are set to see their access to HIV self-tests increase dramatically, following a deal to slash prices in half and boost production, said UnitAid. The International Health Agency said it had closed a deal with the U.S.-based global healthcare company Viatris that will see blood-based HIV self-tests made available for under $2 across 135 low- and middle-income countries. HIV self-tests are seen as vital tools to help people more easily discover their status and move towards the treatment they need, and thus also to reducing the HIV burden globally. This is particularly relevant in poor countries, where concerns around stigma and difficulties accessing healthcare can create significant barriers. Access to self-tests has been recognized as a key factor in meeting the global goal of 90% of people knowing their HIV status, UnitAid spokesman Ervi Verhoosel said. In just the past 6 years, that rate has nearly doubled from 45% to 81% who know their HIV status. But achieving broader testing has been hampered by the fact that the market for HIV self-tests in low and middle-income countries has been dominated by a single affordable oral HIV test, the OraSure. That test is sold at cost in a limited number of poor countries for $2, but elsewhere the price is higher, and other options have cost significantly more. And in more international news, this also from Medical Express, the World Health Organization eyes malaria eradication in 25 countries by 2025. A growing number of countries are stamping out malaria, the World Health Organization said, as it launched an initiative to help eradicate the deadly disease in 25 more countries by 2025. The UN Health Agency insisted that elimination of the diseases that kill some 400,000 people each year around the globe was a viable goal for all countries. Through an initiative launched in 2017, the World Health Organization said it had supported 21 countries in their efforts to bring their malaria caseloads to zero by 2020. 8 of them succeeded in reporting 0 indigenous cases of human malaria by the end of last year, including China, Iran, and Paraguay. And WHO said it now identified a new group of 25 countries, including some from the previous group and some new additions, with the potential to stamp out malaria within a 5-year timeline by 2025. Among the countries in the new group are Guatemala, Honduras, North Korea, and Thailand. These countries will receive specialized support and technical guidance as they work towards the target of zero malaria. In its annual report on malaria published last November, the WHO estimated that some 229 million people had the mosquito-borne disease in 2019, a figure that has been at the same level for the past 4 years. Over 90% of malaria deaths occur in Africa. The majority, more than 265,000 each year, occur in young children. While the annual report decried stalling progress in bringing down the annual number of malaria deaths around the world, WHO said that many countries were gradually winning their battle against the disease. A full 46 of the 87 countries in the world that have malaria reported fewer than 10,000 cases in 2019, a dramatic improvement over the year 2000 when only 26 of them reported so few cases. By the end of last year, 24 of the world's malaria countries reported they had interrupted transmission of the disease for 3 years or more, with 11 of them certified by the World Health Organization as being malaria-free. Their successes were hard-won and came only after decades of concerted action. Okay, well, returning back to America, this from ProPublica. Texas enabled the worst carbon monoxide poisoning catastrophe in recent U.S. history. After the power flicked off in millions of homes across Texas during the state's historic freeze in mid-February, families faced an impossible choice: risk hypothermia or improvise to keep warm. Many brought charcoal grills inside or ran cars in enclosed spaces, either unaware of the dangers or too cold to think rationally. In their desperation, thousands of Texans unwittingly unleashed deadly gases into their homes and apartments that, in many cases, were not equipped with potentially life-saving carbon monoxide alarms, resulting in the country's biggest epidemic of carbon monoxide poisoning in recent history, according to Dr. Neil Hampson, a retired doctor who spent more than 30 years researching carbon monoxide poisoning and prevention. 2 other experts agreed. In the aftermath of the unprecedented wave of poisonings 2 months ago, Texas lawmakers have taken few steps to protect residents from future carbon monoxide catastrophes. That choice caps more than a decade of ignored warnings and inaction that resulted in Texas being one of just 6 states with no statewide requirement for carbon monoxide alarms in homes, ProPublica, the Texas Tribune, and NBC News found. Instead, Texas has a confusing patchwork of local codes, with uneven protection for residents and limited enforcement, all of which most likely contributes to unnecessary deaths, health policy experts said. At least 11 deaths have been confirmed and more than 1,400 people sought care in emergency rooms and urgent care clinics for carbon monoxide poisoning during the week-long Texas outage, just 400 shy of the total for 2020. Children made up 42% of the cases. The totals don't include residents who were poisoned but did not seek care, or those who were treated at hospitals and urgent care clinics who do not voluntarily report data to the state. Black, Hispanic, and Asian Texans suffered a disproportionate share of the carbon monoxide poisonings. These groups accounted for 72% of the poisonings, far more than the 57% share of the state population. Over the past 2 decades, the vast majority of states have implemented laws or regulations requiring carbon monoxide alarms in private residences, often on the heels of high-profile deaths or mass poisonings during storms. But in Texas, where top lawmakers often promote personal responsibility over state mandates, efforts to pass similar carbon monoxide requirements have repeatedly failed. In no uncertain terms, this is a public health disaster. People who lose power should not bring charcoal grills or portable generators inside. Additionally, never run your vehicle inside your garage and then get inside that vehicle as an attempt to get warm. Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas that, at high concentrations, can kill within minutes. In serious cases, those who survive may suffer from permanent brain damage and other long-term health problems, including memory loss, blindness, and hearing damage. And Texas continues to be a cautionary tale in what not to do in public health. Okay, well, at least one long public health battle may be nearing an end. This from The Intercept. Court rules that EPA's delay, quote, exposed a generation of American children to brain-damaging pesticide chlorpyrifos. After 14 years of legal battles, a federal court ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to take actions that will likely force the neurotoxic pesticide chlorpyrifos off the market. The federal agency has for years been considering mounting evidence that links the pesticide to brain damage in children, including loss of IQ, learning difficulties, ADHD, and autism. But, as the court acknowledged, has repeatedly delayed taking action. Rather than ban the pesticide or reduce the tolerances to levels that the EPA could find were reasonably certain to cause no harm, the EPA sought to evade through delay tactics its plain statutory duty, Judge Jed Rakoff wrote in that decision, which was released by the Ninth Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. During that time, the EPA's egregious delay exposed a generation of American children to unsafe levels of chlorpyrifos, he wrote, and ordered the EPA to issue a final regulation within 30 days. While Rakoff stopped short of requiring the EPA to immediately ban the pesticide, he gave the agency little choice in how to respond. The EPA's obligation is clear. It must modify or revoke chlorpyrifos tolerances and modify or cancel chlorpyrifos registrations, Rakoff wrote in his ruling in the case, which was filed by Earth Justice on behalf of the League of United Latin American Citizens, the Pesticide Action Network, United Farm Workers, and other groups. The decision marks the culmination of a prolonged and bitter legal battle over one of the most widely used and dangerous pesticides in U.S. agriculture. More than 5 million pounds of chlorpyrifos were applied to crops in 2017, according to the most recent data. Exposure to the pesticide through residue on food and drift near fields where it has been applied has wreaked devastation on developing children. According to a team of researchers led by Leonardo Trasande, organophosphate pesticides, of which chlorpyrifos is the most widely used, accounted for an estimated $594 billion in societal costs, including added health care and education, between 2001 and 2016. The EPA was poised to ban chlorpyrifos in 2016, but the Trump EPA changed course the next year without providing any scientific justification for its decision. The reversal made under EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has been tied to a $1 million contribution to President Trump's inaugural fund from Dow Chemical Company, now known as Corteva, which was the primary producer of chlorpyrifos. But the EPA had come close to and retreated from banning chlorpyrifos well before the Trump administration, after concerns began to mount in the late 1980s about the harms chlorpyrifos posed to children. Environmental groups pushed to get chlorpyrifos banned. Dow and agricultural groups fought back aggressively against the EPA's regulatory scrutiny, arguing that its removal would lead to shortages of fruits and vegetables. Ultimately, instead of forcing the pesticide off the market, the agency struck a deal in 2000 in which Dow voluntarily withdrew a product containing chlorpyrifos that was used to kill cockroaches and other insects in the home, while the company's agricultural product, Lorsban, remained on the market. Dow continued to fight hard to be able to sell chlorpyrifos well after there was overwhelming evidence that it was causing brain damage in children who were exposed in their early years or born to women who came into contact with the chemical while pregnant. The reason it's taken the agency this long is that Dow refused to give an inch and decided to fight to the last man or woman standing, said Charles Benbrook, an agricultural economist and executive director of the Heartland Health Research Alliance. Inside these chemical companies, it's almost a religious fervor in defending pesticide registrations. Ben Brook, an expert witness in ongoing litigation against Corteva over chlorpyrifos, said that the company supporters helped prolong the process of banning chlorpyrifos. It was the political pressure brought on the agency from the farm state senators, he said. Scientists within the agency had made the case, and the court agreed with the agency. But at the end of the day, the agency didn't have the political support from the White House and Congress that it needed. Patty Goldman, an attorney at Earth Justice, who has been overseeing the chlorpyrifos litigation since 2014, said the disparity between the science and the EPA's refusal to act reached new heights during the Trump years. It became particularly depraved once EPA was finding that chlorpyrifos was causing learning disabilities and lifelong harms to children's brains and not acting to protect them, she said. Upon entering office, Biden issued an executive order that called for a reexamination of the Trump administration's chlorpyrifos decision. Last year, Corteva announced that it would stop making chlorpyrifos, but other companies still make the pesticide, and the EPA continues to allow its use. EPA is reviewing the decision as it considers its option, agency spokesperson Nick Conger said in response to an inquiry from The Intercept. While the agency weighs these options, Goldman expressed guarded optimism. The court is saying what we've been saying all along, she said, but we still need EPA to do the right thing.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, this next story may fit under the well, duh category, but it's important to get documented evidence on this. This from Medical Express. Gender-affirming surgeries improve mental health in young, study says. When gender-diverse or transgender people have surgeries to affirm their gender, they experience a variety of positive mental health outcomes, new research shows. The study found an association between the surgeries, which participants had at least 2 years prior to a survey, and significantly lower rates of past month psychological distress, past year suicidal ideation, and past year smoking, compared to transgender and gender-diverse people who had not had gender-affirming surgery but wanted it. The findings come at a particularly critical time, as some states move to ban certain gender-affirming treatments and surgeries for transgender minors. The study, published in the journal JAMA Surgery, provides scientific evidence to add to existing clinical information where existing data was limited, and that can have real implications on policy-based access challenges. We've seen, for example, that it's still quite common for health insurers to routinely deny coverage for certain types of gender-affirming surgery, and that's partly due to limited evidence for their health benefits. We've conducted this study to fill these really crucial evidence gaps in hopes that it will help us both improve clinical care and work towards policies that ensure more expansive, equitable, and affirming care for transgender and gender-diverse populations. The gender-affirming surgery can reduce confidence, romantic relationships, and other interpersonal relationships, such as in the workplace. Other studies have shown that there have been a fivefold increase in gender-affirming surgeries in recent years. Access to care is one of the reasons, including the rapid expansion of dedicated gender-affirming care practices in the United States. Still, many areas do not have programs to provide this care. Meanwhile, some states are working to criminalize certain transgender care. Arkansas, for example, has become the first state to ban gender-affirming care for transgender minors, NBC News reported earlier this month. We're very concerned about these laws that would prohibit or criminalize access to gender-affirming medical care for minors. These aren't based on any clinical expertise or research evidence. In a statement released by the American Medical Association, they urged state governors to oppose legislation that prohibits providing medically necessary gender transition-related care to minor patients. We believe this legislation represents a dangerous governmental intrusion into the practice of medicine and will be detrimental to the health of transgender children across the country, read the letter signed by Dr. James Madera, CEO and Executive Vice President of the AMA. Every major medical association in the United States recognizes the medical necessity of transition-related care for improving the physical and mental health of transgender people, the letter said. Foregoing gender-affirming care can have tragic consequences. Empirical evidence has demonstrated that trans and non-binary gender identities are normal variations of human identity and expression, the American Medical Association said. Sadly, transgender individuals are 3 times more likely than the general population to have a mental health disorder, and this is widely thought to be consequences of the stress of being a minority, chronic stress from coping with social stigma, and discrimination based on their gender identity and expression, the association said. And another story that may be of little surprise to some people, this from Science Daily, spanking may affect the brain development of a child. Spanking may affect a child's brain development in similar ways to more severe forms of violence, according to a new study led by Harvard researchers. The research published in the journal Child Development builds on existing studies that show heightened activity in certain regions of the brain of children who experience abuse in response to threat cues. We know that children whose families use corporal punishment are more likely to develop anxiety, depression, behavior problems, and other mental health problems. But many people don't think about spanking as a form of violence, said Katie McLaughlin, director of the Stress and Development Lab in the Department of Psychology and senior researcher on the study. According to the study's authors, corporal punishment has been linked to the development of mental health issues, anxiety, depression, behavioral problems, and substance use disorders. And recent studies show that approximately half of parents in the U.S. reported spanking their children in the past year and 1/3 in the past week. However, the relationship between spanking and brain activity has not previously been studied. The findings are in line with a similar research conducted on children who had experienced severe violence, suggesting that while we might not conceptualize corporal punishment to be a form of violence, in terms of how a child's brain responds, it's not all that different than abuse, said McLaughlin. It's more a difference of degree than of type. Ultimately, added McLaughlin, we're hopeful that this finding may encourage families not to use this strategy, and that it may open people's eyes to the potential negative consequences of corporal punishment in ways that they haven't thought of before. Okay, well, I'm going to close an interesting article about health messaging around weight, this from Medical Express. The clear message on promoting body positivity. Public health campaigns that challenge weight stigma and promote body positivity can boost the health and well-being for people of all body sizes, according to a University of Queensland study. The School of Psychology scholar Joanne Rathbone had led the project to examine how different public health messages affect people's behaviors. Public health messages often encourage weight loss and focus on the risks that excess weight might pose to health, which can be stigmatizing. We looked at how alternative ways of framing public health messages affected people and compared those outcomes with those from typical weight loss messages. The alternative messages we tested either did not mention weight, explicitly targeted people of all body sizes without focusing on weight loss, or challenged weight stigma, encouraged body positivity and size acceptance. We examined how these different public health messages affected people's perceptions of weight stigma, their motivation to engage in healthy behaviors like eating fruits and vegetables and exercising, and unhealthy behaviors that are associated with disordered eating like skipping meals or purging. We also asked people about their body satisfaction and self-esteem after viewing these messages. Ms. Rathbone said the alternative messages did not affect everyone equally. They affected health behaviors and well-being differently depending on the actual or perceived weight of the audience, she said. Removing mention of weight from the message only had a positive impact for people with a lower weight. Messages that targeted people of all body sizes without focusing on weight loss increased higher weight people's motivation to engage in healthy behaviors. For lower weight people, these messages made them feel less satisfied with their bodies. Messages that challenged weight stigma and encouraged body positivity and size acceptance had a predominantly positive effect on psychological well-being for people of all body sizes. However, these messages also reduce motivation for healthy behaviors that are often associated with weight loss and reduce body satisfaction for lower weight people. Ms. Rathbone said, public health campaigns need to move away from focusing on weight loss and should avoid using weight stigmatizing content. Past researchers indicated time and time again that public health messages that focus on weight loss and use weight-stigmatizing content are unlikely to be effective at encouraging healthy behaviors. In fact, the evidence suggests that these messages can actually be harmful to people's health and well-being. There are alternative, non-stigmatizing ways in which we can frame public health messages, but there is no one-size-fits-all approach. Careful consideration needs to be given to the weight-related framing of public health messages based on the goals that these messages are trying to achieve and the target audience. Just another example of how non-judgmental attitudes are very important in effective public health practice. Okay, well, lastly, but not leastly, I've got some bonus articles for you to read online. Got five of them this week. Number one, inequality's deadly toll. A century of research has demonstrated how poverty and discrimination drive disease. Can COVID push science to finally address this issue? Two, long-haul COVID-19 sufferers take a page from the HIV/AIDS activism to be heard. Three, is the U.S. doing enough to address the meat industry's role in antibiotic resistance? Despite significant progress in chicken, experts say routine use of medically important antibiotics remains widespread in pork and beef production. Four, end fracking exemptions, which are a threat to maternal and public health. Five, America, please don't forget the victims of Agent Orange. You can view these articles and all the articles referenced in today's episode at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.